government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Federalist Society Free Lunch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our biweekly newsletter for alerts about new content and events, and also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn to track our progress. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. Today's podcast focuses on a dispute between an Army veteran, Adam Jackson, and the state of Tennessee. The Tennessee Alarm Systems Contractors Board has prohibited Adam from selling or even donating his groundbreaking facial recognition software that he contends could save lives, specifically in schools and churches. The software scans faces using existing security cameras and compares the image against known offender databases. The Tennessee Alarm Board determined the software constitutes an alarm system, requiring Adam to spend 5 years to obtain a government license before he can use his product. The Beacon Center of Tennessee is assisting Mr. Jackson in his fight against the board in what is called another example of a licensing law that hurts everyone. I'm pleased to welcome both Adam Jackson and Braden Busek of the Beacon Center to our program today to discuss. Adam Jackson joined the Army in 2007. He served as an infantryman in the 82nd Airborne Division. While there, he deployed to Kandahar, Afghanistan from 2009 to 2010. He started the Special Forces Qualification Course in 2011. Upon graduation, he was assigned to 5th Special Forces Group. As a member of the 5th SFG, he deployed to Jordan, Iraq, and Syria. While in Jordan, he spearheaded an effort to equip a Jordanian intelligence unit with secure internet. In 2016, Adam deployed to Iraq and eventually moved from Iraq to Syria. His team was one of the first Special Forces teams in Syria. Upon returning from his last deployment, Adam started a computer vision company that specializes in facial recognition security systems. He's a self-taught programmer, computer networking technician, system integration specialist, and security consultant. Braden Busek is a regular here to the Free Lunch Podcast and also is the director of litigation at the Beacon Center of Tennessee. The Beacon Center is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, and independent organization dedicated to providing expert empirical research and timely free market solutions to public policy issues in Tennessee. Braden manages the in-house legal matters and litigation for the Beacon Center. Adding to Braden's extensive litigation experience is his work as an assistant United States attorney in both Nashville and Memphis, and before that, his work as a prosecutor for the state of Tennessee, first as an assistant attorney general and later as an assistant district attorney. I'm pleased to say that Braden also serves on the RTP state and local regulation working group. If you'd like to learn more about Adam, Braden, or the state and local working group, please visit regproject.org. Before we begin, I'd like to remind our listeners that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcast are those of our featured speakers. Our guests will take questions after their remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have for them prior to the start of the question and answer period. Thank you, Adam and Braden, for participating in today's Free Lunch Podcast, and thank you, Adam, for your service to our country. I'll now turn the floor over to you, Adam, to get us started. The floor is now yours, sir. Thank you.
This is Adam Jackson, and first I wanted to thank Devin and the Reg Project for having us on today and letting us tell our story. So like Devin said in his opening remarks, I was in the military and kind of trying to figure out what I was going to do when I got out and decided that artificial intelligence was the future, and started looking at what I could do to actually make a difference in the world. About that time, I had my first kid, and we started looking at daycares and preschools, and I noticed that I wasn't comfortable with the security in any of those facilities. So I reached out to a couple of friends that all had backgrounds in special operations and technology, and we got together and decided that there wasn't any reason that some of the high-level technology that is used to protect dignitaries and politicians and celebrities shouldn't be available to protect kids, and there was no reason it needed to cost what it did. And we wanted to build a solution that really any organization that has a duty to protect kids could afford. So we started looking at what that exactly looked like and decided that the biggest threat that young kids face is either a non-custodial parent or a sex offender entering the building with bad intentions. And at, you know, grade school and beyond, we thought active shooters in the schools was the biggest threat those organizations faced. So then we sat down to figure out how to solve that problem and came up with a facial recognition system that that incorporated sex offender databases, known bad actors in the school, whether that was non-custodial parents, expelled students, or just people that had caused problems in the past, and looked at how we incorporate or how we stop those people from entering the school. And what we came up with was this facial recognition system. And we set out to write code that could be run on normal computers. So it just didn't cost what it costs to, you know, to run a system like this for the president, for example. So we ended up, you know, we kind of came up with a game plan that would allow us to create a system that costs somewhere between $1,500 and $2,500 with a monthly subscription charge, that could run a single camera in a school and match the faces or scan the faces of everyone that walked in against those databases. In the process of forming the company, we decided that we were just going to bootstrap it and do all of this in garages and guest bedrooms at our houses. Because we knew if we took on investors, we'd have to answer to the investor why we weren't charging what everybody else is charging for a product like this. That caused a financial strain, but I think it also made us stronger as a company. So in the process of forming the company, we were informed by a lawyer that alarm systems were regulated in Tennessee, and the regulatory board for alarm systems was extremely aggressive in going after people they felt weren't complying with their regulation. I decided to go in front of that board, basically preemptively. And I went unrepresented, which in the end was a mistake. I thought the board would look at the product and see it clearly wasn't an alarm system and that it would be a quick, easy resolution. That wasn't the case. I appeared in front of the board on June 22nd. I mean, the board consists of people that all own alarm companies, and talked to them about the system, kind of what it does and how it works. And basically the beauty of our system is once our testing is complete, really, we believe that anyone will be able to install and maintain it. So we appeared in front of the board and explained that for our system is nothing more than a normal desktop like you'd find in anyone's house, and the entire installation process consists, the physical installation process consists of plugging one Ethernet cable into a wall. The board told us that they thought we were an alarm system, but essentially didn't know, couldn't articulate exactly why we were an alarm system, but nevertheless decided that we were an alarm system. So since June 22nd, of last year, because we were bootstrapping the company, we didn't have the option to go out and hire a PR firm and several lawyers. So we were put in contact with the Beacon Center, who has been pretty amazing in this process and in trying to get some sort of resolution to allow us to protect kids and do it at a price that I think any preschool can afford. So since my appearance before the board, we filed a motion with the administrative court in Tennessee to just make the board clarify itself and tell us that yes or no, tell us yes or no on whether or not we're an alarm system and exactly why we are an alarm system. That is where Braden comes in, and at this point I'll just turn it over to Braden and let him kind of explain where we're at in that process.
Hi, this is Braden Busek, Director of Litigation from the Beacon Center. Adam's pretty well outlined the background of this case. And when we took it on, we have elected to pursue this case through the Administrative Procedures Act that allows claims to be heard through the actual board governing the profession itself. Adam's case is fascinating both substantively in terms of the legal questions it presents, but also procedurally in terms of what it has exposed about the administrative process and the deficiencies that lay therein. Now, I'm actually going to spend more time on the latter rather than the former, just because I think it's a little bit more revealing and more novel territory. But substantively, just to touch on it, you know, this is a classic example of something we increasingly are becoming aware of, and that's this tendency of that we refer to as regulatory mismatch, and that is the desire of regulatory boards who are looking to govern new technologies using old and misfitting or regulations. This is a glaring example because alarms are the very sort of thing that technology is rapidly making obsolete. As many of you know, you can go to big box stores now and get devices that you can install yourself designed to work for your cell phones that are essentially alarm systems and cameras and all these sorts of things that used to have tremendous technological needed to have tremendous technological capacity in order to install, but that's no longer the case. And so there's a very real possibility that what exactly the administrative board here, the Tennessee Alarm Systems Contractor Board, will be regulating is a shrinking, if not vanishing, territory altogether. But there's any other number of other constitutional problems that we've alleged too. For instance, the Alarm Systems Act has any number of exemptions in it. For instance, red light cameras are exempted. Hospitals are exempted. There's actually an exemption for manufacturers who wish to install but do $50 million more of business. So the key distinction between Adam as a startup and some of the bigger, more established manufacturing companies is simply the size and scope of his business. So in many ways, Adam has been treated differently than other businesses that are otherwise similarly situated. We also see this as essentially a speech claim. For instance, if somebody wanted to sit in front of one of these daycares, to use that example, and that person went out every morning to the post office and memorized all of the faces of people on the wanted posters and then saw somebody walking in that appeared to recognize it, if the government tried to say you had to have a professional license before you could go and notify the principal that it looks like a suspicious person is on the premises, we would rightly recognize that as a free speech violation and a prior restraint. But if for some reason, because there's technology involved, we have more of a difficulty in identifying it. So these are the sorts of claims that we wish to see explored at some point in time by a court. But currently, as constituted, we're doing the administrative process. And so now I want to turn the page to the procedural aspect of this, which, again, I think is far more revealing from a lawyer standpoint than the mere substantive claims. And I was really taken last week by the podcast Arizona Dumps Deference with John Riches from the Goldwater Institute and Philip Hamburger, a professor, who, in particular, Professor Hamburger made a point at one point in time that I wrote it down because it really resonated with me as I was gathering my thoughts in anticipation of this podcast. He said that we need to view this as a civil rights issue, that being Chevron deference and the administrative process. And indeed, our experience has been exactly that. There's really little dispute that Adam's rights are at stake. Indeed, the rights that are at stake are deeply personal and some of Adam's most important rights. I mean, you heard him relate that what this system has meant to him is essentially his future and his ability to provide for his family. And so there's a tremendous personal and property right here at stake as well. And the administrative body that we brought this to has denied that it has any ability to even consider the constitutional claims that we've presented. Now, as any number of lawyers who have ever litigated in this space will tell you, myself included, that if we had foregone the administrative process and taken this straight to a court, we would have been beset by any number of complaints that we failed to avail ourselves of the administrative process, and that therefore we have not properly exhausted our claims, and therefore we are not properly before the court itself. Yet when you do exactly what you have been told to do and present this in front of the Administrative Procedures Act, you are told that we cannot and will not hear these claims. So it's essentially a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose proposition. And this very much undercuts the case for the Chevron deference that administrative agencies clamor for in the first place. You know, Chevron deference, without going too deeply into it, rests on the idea that the administrative bodies have a sort of technical expertise within their field to which courts should defer to on matters governing how particular statutes govern the field. But here, there's really no expertise available to the people on the Alarm Systems Board about what Adam's trying to do, because what Adam's trying to do is compile a software and database system. And there's nothing about installing closed-circuit TV or installing burglar alarms that gives anyone any sort of expertise in judging Adam's alarm system or whether or not it meets the existing definitions of an alarm, to say nothing of its effect on his constitutional rights. Indeed, it could fairly be argued that the board members themselves might have just enough expertise to realize what a threat Adam's software technology presents to their existing business model altogether. And in that sense, it prevents all sorts of perverse incentives for the board to assume control over new technologies that can present threats to their existing business model. And I was struck when Professor Hamburger said last week that these regulatory boards can pound you down and hold you at the ankle so you never get in front of an Article III judge. Thus, he argued that Chevron cuts the heart out of an Article III judge. And that's the dilemma that we are potentially facing here, because by the time that this case actually gets to an actual court, you will have the administrative board arguing for deference and the failure to exhaust, when, of course, any failure to have presented the constitutional claims is solely attributable to the refusal of the administrative boards to consider the claims in the first place. And so what's the solution? Well, we haven't gotten there yet, so we don't really know what cards they'll play. We've done everything we can do to try and assert and preserve this record to show that the fault lies with the administrative board and not with Adam. But one can quite easily envision a situation where even after the alarm board is entirely at fault for us not presenting these constitutional claims, that once we get in front of a judge, they would argue, number one, they failed to exhaust, and number two, even if we had a hand in that, the remedy is to remand this back to the administrative board to consider the constitutional claims. Now, this, in essence, it makes the point about how Chevron and how the administrative process can cut the hearts out of the judicial process, because Adam's claim is particularly time-sensitive. There is a need to resolve his claim as expeditiously as essential because technology moves so fast in the field into which he wishes to enter. Stated differently, if Adam can't bring his product to market quickly, then it's really the same as not bringing it at all. And thus, delay and remand through the administrative process, tangling him in this impossible-to-win game, is the same thing as ending his business altogether. And if Adam had a crystal ball a year ago when he first went before the board, he might have reasonably concluded that whether or not the alarm system had jurisdiction or not, the proper and smart thing to do would have been to just agree to their demands, because at the end of the day, they would have mooted and obsoleted his business altogether. So this is really not proceeded with sufficient celerity. You know, Adam talked about how he originally devised this software years ago. On June 22nd, when he first presented the claim unrepresented to the board, that was when they first told him he had an alarm system. In December, we asked for a petition. They agreed to set it in April, and then that was all postponed until November. And only once we lose can we finally get it in front of a court, and it remains to be seen whether the court will even entertain those claims. Throughout, there has been inadequacy of discovery or enforcement of discovery, with the board repeatedly claiming that it is unable to get us even basic answers to our interrogatories or produce documents. And so essentially we are going into this administrative procedure flying blind in a way that we never would had we taken this directly to the court. And so in short, you know, both substantively and procedurally, we see a process that implicates Adam's core constitutional rights, some of his most important and personal rights, and it remains to be seen whether or not he can get satisfactory relief through the administrative process. So at this point in time, I'm going to turn it back over to Devin and allow the floor to open so people can ask questions if that's what they want to do.
Outstanding, Braden. Thank you so much. And thank you, Adam, for sharing your story. I'm sure we'll have some questions about your story and, Braden, some follow-up to the comments that you've made. But right now, let me go ahead and open up the floor to audience questions. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll answer your question in the order it's received. I'm going to turn on the floor now. Okay. The floor request mode is on, so if you have a question for our guest today, all you need to do is enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Again, when we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. We're going to answer the questions in the order in which they are received. Let me first ask a follow-up question. I think it's basically directed at you, Braden, but Adam, you may have some things that you want to say about this as well, and I'll allow our listeners to get queued up here. Braden, you mentioned that this is sort of a classic example of regulatory mismatch. I'm not going to repeat what you said, but is this a situation also perhaps where the board's authority is just simply overbroad? And if that's the case, does the Tennessee legislature have a role here?
I would say yes to both counts. This is Braden again. So the alarm system law, as drafted, defines alarm systems as anything that can be used to design or summon aid for a potential emergency. And now, this was a law that came into effect, I believe it was 1991. And of course, when this was being drawn up, absolutely nobody was envisioning apps or the sort of software technology that we have now. And so we've pointed out that if Adam's facial recognition software meets the definition of an alarm system, then most of the apps on your phone that carry any sort of a notification based on location are going to meet this definition as well. I mean, if you think about it, if you are on Yelp, Yelp is designed to tell you that based on where you are, there's such and such location near you. If you think about Pokemon Go, that's going to give you a pop-up notice saying, hey, that there's a Pokemon near you. And so you can go on and on through Waze and other sorts of applications that if mere notification of something that is proximate or time-sensitive constitutes an alarm system, then the board has the potential to get its arms around a vast number of routine and completely innocuous technologies that we use in our day-to-day life. And, you know, just looking forward, when driverless cars get here, that is something, too, that is going to rely on software that identifies location and gives time-sensitive notices. And we need to be giving that room to run and room to flourish and not strangling it in the crib.
Well, Devin, this is Adam. I'll just add that at my appearance before the board, I'm standing in front of a panel of people that are supposed to be that told me they had the ability to regulate my product, but they were asking questions that they were asking questions that were so basic and so it was so hard for them to understand what the software actually did that I don't know that we ever really got to the meat and potatoes of kind of what the product is, because it was just so far outside of their level of expertise, which made it hard for me to accept that they're the body that is saying that they can, that they're saying they're the body to regulate my product.
That's incredible. I mean, Braden?
Let me jump in there. I just want to illustrate what Adam was saying for the benefit of people who obviously haven't watched this transcript. But, you know, Adam tried very hard to try and pin them down on what it was that made his software an alarm system. And one of the answers that he got a variety of answers, but one of the answers he got was, well, it involves wiring. And the sort of wiring that Adam's product does is plugging in your Ethernet cable into the wall. Okay, so if you're plugging in your computer to access the Internet, that's wiring. And, of course, that's very different wiring, the sort of electrical wiring that, you know, a traditional alarm system would have. And, you know, I think Adam shot back. He goes, well, you know, I could conceivably do this with, like, a RTP wireless feed. And they said, oh, if you did that, then you might not be an alarm system. Now, I mean, you don't have to have great technical sophistication. I certainly don't. But to realize that the distinction between Wi-Fi and an Ethernet cable is entirely arbitrary.
That's really incredible. I mean, I'm concerned that maybe someday I want to move to Tennessee and affix perhaps a bell to the outside door, you know, the door to my home, and if it alerts me that someone has entered, then maybe I need to get a 5-year apprenticeship and license before doing something like that. So this is concerning, and I have seen the video of the. Of Adam's appearance before the board is available, I think, in some materials that we provided prior to this call. And it is, right or wrong, it is cringeworthy. I encourage everyone to watch it. In any event, let's get on to more important questions. We've got a couple here in the queue. If anyone else has a question they'd like to join the queue, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We'll go to our first question now.
Hi, this is Jim Doyle in Baltimore. And thank you for the presentation. I found it very interesting. One thing you had mentioned was that the state board in this case is composed of people in the business who are licensed by the board, but I suppose in the business, and in that sense, I assume, you know, competitors of this technology. So my question really was, and you had mentioned constitutional claims, which I think seem to be very valid. But in addition, I was wondering whether there had been thought to antitrust claims pursuant to the similar to the North Carolina Dental Association case that went to the Supreme Court, you know, regarding teeth whitening sales. And so I was just curious as to whether or not the antitrust claims also play a role in this, and if they do, how that would impact the issue of exhaustion of administrative remedies. Thank you.
Sure. So this is Braden. I'll jump in. You know, the antitrust route would just be in a different direction, and I'm not dismissing the validity of it as a possible avenue. It's just a different avenue, and I think it would be difficult to do both simultaneously. But it certainly does pose some of the problems that you identified from the North Carolina Dental case. You've got a board made up of existing market participants. You've got them trying to mischaracterize something that he's got as a professional activity. There are some differences in the matter of Tennessee state law and North Carolina dental law. And, for instance, the Tennessee legislature just last year passed a law that's designed to give these regulatory boards their immunity back without really doing anything to make them any more competitive. And that would pose a practical hurdle to trying to get to the meat of an antitrust claim itself. So, that's just touching on some of our initial thoughts with respect to antitrust claims. To your final question, no, there would not be any exhaustion requirement. Should Adam elect to pursue antitrust claims, he could take any of that straight to court. But of course, at that point in time, you would face a whole different set of challenges.
Well, and this is Adam here, and I'll just jump in. I'm a complete layman, no legal expertise whatsoever. But during the hearing itself, there was one board member in particular that brought up about 7 times that he thought my only option was to just license it to existing alarm companies, to the point that another board member turned away from his mic and told him that, you know, basically that was enough. I don't understand the legal side of it, but just as a layman, it felt anti-competitive that I was standing in front of a board that is composed of people that own alarm companies who are telling me my only option was to license my software to alarm companies.
Really interesting to hear sort of your perspective on that, Adam. And thank you for the question, caller. Braden, I want to follow up on something that you mentioned. I just want to be clear here. Is it your view that the, I can't remember what the board is called now, but the Alarm System Board is under NC, North Carolina State Board of Dental Examiners, the FTC, the case that the caller referenced, that the alarm board is actively supervised by the state of Tennessee?
Well, I wouldn't quite go that far. What I would say is that last year the Tennessee legislature passed a law that was designed to give the board the appearance of active supervision without requiring that they become any more competitive. In fact, we injected ourselves into the legislative process to try and say active supervision is a good thing, but it's a means to an end, and the end should be market competition. And our efforts to try and require that any supervision would need to be in the interest of consumers and market competition were not successful. And thus, we have a law that is designed. Whether or not it succeeded, I'm not in a position to say. I think there's reason to think that the fix was insufficient to address the Supreme Court's concern in NC Dental, but it is nevertheless certainly designed to make it much more difficult to bring an antitrust claim in Tennessee.
I see. Well, thank you for the answer, Brayden and Adam, and again, thank you, questioner, for your free question. We'll go on to our next question here. I see that we have another one queued up, but before we do, I'd like to quickly make an announcement, and that is that you all should mark your calendars. Next week, the Regulatory Transparency Project will host an event at the Capitol Hill Club in Washington, D.C. on Friday the 18th from 12 o'clock noon to 1:30. We'll have a luncheon where we'll discuss emerging technology legislation and regulation in drone delivery, autonomous vehicles, flight sharing, and more. Our speakers will be Pepperdine Law and Policy Professor Greg McNeil, a research fellow in the Technology Policy Program at Mercatus Center at George Mason University, Brent Skorup, a Senior Director of Strategy and Research at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University, Christopher Koopman, and Director of Technology Policy at the Niskanen Center, Ryan Hageman. Again, mark your calendars. This is a luncheon next week, Friday, May 18th, at the Capitol Hill Club in Washington, D.C. Everyone is welcome to attend. We'll be discussing emerging technology legislation and regulation from noon to 1:30. Okay, why don't we go on to our next question here.
Yes, this is Steve Herb, and I am in Columbus, Ohio. I'm finding this to be a very fascinating topic. I'm enjoying this this event today. I'd like to point out that this is an excellent example of disruptive technology and how our government at all levels is struggling with how to govern. Examples would be, of course, cryptocurrency and Uber. If Adam had asked for my advice last year before he chose to go before the Administrative Alarm Board, I would have said, rush to market and ask forgiveness later, just like Uber did instead of asking for taxi licenses around the country. The taxi cab industry is an excellent, and what Uber did is an excellent example of how entrepreneurs are not piddling around and allowing the government with their antiquated laws and administrative regulations to try to do this type of thing. So, Adam, hats off to you. But I'm sorry to hear that they are basically crippling you and having their own oligopoly to try to stop you. Thank you.
This is Braden. I'll jump in. I think that's a very astute observation. It's interesting to have heard your perspective on what you would have told him in advance. I can't prove it, but I suspect you're probably correct that Adam would have been better off if he had asked for forgiveness instead of permission. Adam, however, is both literally and figuratively a good soldier, and I think it's in his DNA to observe chain of command, and that's how he ended up in front of that alarm system board. He may well have been better off had he just simply never brought himself to their attention and then fought the fight afterwards if he needed to. I suspect that there's any number of similar companies who have observed what has happened to Adam and just said they're going to keep their head low and keep working and deal with it on the back end if it gets there. But I think there's tremendous harm to cultural cohesion and our values of rule of law when that becomes an accepted norm. And I think it is becoming an accepted norm. That is, that we just say, ignore the law that may or may not apply to you and hope for the best and then fight it if it does. But I can tell you, as a public interest litigator in this realm, I have that conversation a lot with people who just opt to just engage in some form of, you might characterize it as, civil disobedience, and then they'll fight if they have to. But I do think that it represents something of a watershed moment, where you have vast numbers of otherwise law-abiding Americans who are just accepting the fact that they are, in some sense, outlaws, and will fight if they have to. And I think that that's really disappointing, and that that's part of the reason why we should embrace regulatory reform that would give a large room to run for disruptive technologies, so that they don't have to be outlaws and hope for the best. Not everybody's going to be Uber and manage to make it work.
So this is Adam here, if I can just jump in. We actually did sit down and have a conversation about just taking the product to market and letting the chips fall where they may. The reason we ended up going in front of the board is the board has the authority to fine people that violate their statutes $1,000 to $5,000. Every single time that they commit what the board would consider an illegal act. With our business model being to provide this security to the people that otherwise couldn't afford it, and to use it to protect kids, we knew that if the board did end up coming after us and started imposing fines, we would have to back down and essentially break a promise to these schools and churches and other organizations, and leave them with an unmaintained system. And to us, morally and ethically, we could not risk that when the consequences were what they were.
Thank you for the responses there, Adam and Braden. And I think a really great question as well, which gets to a question that I have. And if you'll humor me again, we've got a couple of questions queued up, but we'll get to those. We have plenty of time. And if anyone else has a question on the call, all you need to do is hit star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to you. But I do wonder also, Adam, whether or not you took into consideration whether or not you would take this. This is not a term that I've coined, but I've heard others use, taking this permissionless innovation route and spontaneously deregulating the space. Whether or not you considered the fact that your system, your software, your program is almost sort of minority reporty. coining that. And for those who do not know, on the call, Minority Report is a film based on, I think, a book of the same name by Steven Spielberg, which is science fiction. But essentially, the federal government adopts a controversial program where they try to stop murderers and other violent criminals before they act. And I imagine that might be concerning to folks, especially if you're sort of going this permissionless innovation route. Is this of any concern to you, or was it then that this would be that you wouldn't win sort of in the court of public opinion around that issue?
Yeah, so to address the Minority Report concerns first, our test for that was, would we be comfortable having this installed in a school that our children attended? Talking about me and my partners in the company. And we had to get to yes on that before we decided we had a minimum viable product. And so the way we handled that was our software, once it's installed in the school, we don't have the ability to go in and gather data on students. We don't have the ability to tap into video feeds. We don't have from outside of the building. All of the recognition software exists in the building. All of the databases are stored locally and then updated. Rather than going out and, accessing broad databases that are kept by both public and private organizations. The databases that schools could use would be pretty limited to sex offenders and individuals they added themselves at the school. So I think, you know, while there's always going to be that debate about, you know, new technology and privacy, I think, you know, from our perspective, we did everything we could to make sure that this technology wouldn't be abused in the ways that a lot of other technologies are abusing technology like this.
And just to follow up, to put a point on it, this is not software for use by the government of the general public. This is surveillance software for specific businesses to use it. And, of course, the consumer would be perfectly willing to agree or disagree to it. You know, most private businesses already have surveillance cameras, and this is something that would work alongside those surveillance cameras. And so you would have the ability to essentially elect whether or not you wish to be a part of it. But as somebody who drops off two kids each morning to a school where there's an armed guard up front, I certainly would welcome and prefer something like this, even though I would be uncomfortable if this was something that was being used on the sidewalks.
So to kind of add to what Braden said, we don't actually save any data that is collected by the cameras. So we're not saving facial measurements on the system. Everything is deleted within 30 seconds of it being gathered. The only time any data would be saved is if a match occurred between someone that walked by a camera and someone the school wanted to identify. And the software doesn't alert law enforcement. It actually just sends either a text, an email, or a local alert to somebody that is on site at the school with a picture of, you know, the quote unquote bad guy and the person that looks like the bad guy. And then the whoever receives that notification makes the decision on what their next action is.
Well, again, thanks for humoring me, Adam and Braden. I think it's useful to take a deeper dive into the software and how it actually is intended to work. So thanks for that. And hopefully that was useful to some of our listeners. Okay, we've got a couple questions queued up. If anyone else has a question, enter star and then pound or your telephone keypad and we'll get to you. Caller, when I get to you, you'll hear a prompt and you can ask your question. Here we go.
Thank you, gentlemen. This is Jack Park. One observation, had you gone to market, the burden would have been on the board to try to enjoin you, and your defense would have been that this doesn't fall within the scope of their powers. But that's just an observation. Braden, have you thought about taking this to the Federal Trade Commission as an anti-competitive measure?
Potentially. You know, in the past, the FTC, for instance, has issued an advisory opinion regarding some issues going on their veterinary board governing the practice of animal massage, which is another case I worked on. So while we have not lodged this as a formal complaint, in the past the only way we've come at this is when there's been pending legislation and we've gotten lawmakers to solicit the FTC's input. But it very well may be worth thinking about whether or not there'd be room to potentially submit this as an FTC matter. I suspect that's a discussion that we should probably have after our hearing, provided that Adam does not get the relief he seeks. For the benefit of everyone listening, the board's official position to us has been, we have made no decision as to whether or not Adam's decision is an alarm system. We won't tell you what we think. We'll let you know in August, but it's up to you to convince us. This is notwithstanding the fact that Adam was there in June 22nd of last year, and they very, very clearly told him at that time that his system was an alarm system.
Thanks.
Thanks very much, Jack. And again, if you have a question, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We'll just move right along to our next question.
Good afternoon. This is Jeremy Kidd. I teach at Mercer Law School, and a fascinating discussion. One thing that kind of struck me was in this discussion was, I mean, I don't want to second guess Adam's decision to go ask permission, but it does. I'm concerned about the way we reference this in terms of the rule of law, that, you know, Uber, we tend to say things like Uber, you know, decided not to ask for permission, but Uber wasn't a taxi cab company and therefore shouldn't have had to ask for permission. And Adam's product clearly isn't an alarm system and therefore shouldn't have to ask permission. And unless we're willing to concede to the government this notion that what is not expressly permitted is prohibited, I think we run the risk of actually doing damage to the rule of law by jumping on board that and kind of conceding that to the government. So I understand why Adam did what he did, and I think would never want to second guess anyone because I wasn't in that position. But it just seems to me that that's the wrong way to look at these types of questions.
This is Braden. I'll jump in. Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for your question. I don't disagree with anything you've said. However, what I would say in response is that it isn't that Adam is conceding that he needed the alarm system's permission any more than we would concede that Uber needed the taxicab's permission. But the fact of the matter is, even though he is not an alarm system, that would not stop the alarm system from necessarily trying to wrap their arms around him. Indeed, that's exactly what they did. In much the same way that we saw taxi cab companies try and say Uber is a taxi cab company. Even if they're wrong, the fact is they can do it or they can characterize it, and then they have tremendous power under the force of law to do something about it. And so as Adam alluded to, you know, they have the ability to fine him. I think the last caller alluded to the ability to enjoin them. I also point out that they actually have the ability to seek criminal penalties. This is, in fact, a crime in Tennessee to operate as an alarm system installer without a license. And so I think many, if not most people, eyeing a situation where they could say, well, we may not be an alarm system, but if they think we are and we're wrong, then the consequences of that are crippling civil fines and possible criminal sanctions. Most people are just going to err on the side of caution and try and convince them prospectively that they're not an alarm system, if not get an alarm system to begin with. And I will say, you know, I totally agree that Adam is not an alarm system, but it's not something that the board has just come out and said, yes, you're obviously right, you're not an alarm system. Why are we even undergoing this process? And I can't guarantee that the administrative judge will agree with Adam's position, let alone the actual judges who will hear this if and when we lose in front of the administrative judge. But go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm not trying to make an argument about Adam. I think, like I said, I wouldn't ever second guess anyone in the position, especially since, as he pointed out, he didn't have, you know, venture capital funding. He didn't have deep pockets like Uber's founders did. My point isn't about Adam. I think what he decided to do is completely reasonable and legitimate. I worry about those of us who really care about the rule of law, and we need to at least be aware that by doing this, if we are willing to concede to boards like this alarm board, which is, I think, exactly the equivalent of the dental board in North Carolina, if we concede to them, basically, you have the right to rent seek at the public expense, then I think we surrender the rule of law to that. We denigrate the rule of law. We downgrade the rule of law rather than supporting it. And it was the statement that was made earlier, and it may have been just in passing and not really meant this way. But it seemed to me that it may have been you, Braden, that said it, that this, you know, in terms of the rule of law, that this was an important thing to do. And I just wanted to point out that I think that's wrong. I think that's the wrong way to think about it, that the rule of law requires that people like Adam, who are not actually alarm systems, they are free to innovate and do what they want. And the government does not get to say, unless you have our express permission, you are prohibited. Now, they try that, and they would have tried to come back on Adam like they tried to come back on Uber. But you'll notice that what's the one thing that's been able to destroy the power of taxi commissions across the U.S., except for obviously in major cities that have, you know, certain factors, and that is Uber. Uber destroyed the power of taxi commissions, much for the better. I mean, we're all better because of it, and not Adam, but as society innovates, society should be thinking of this in terms of, I'm not going to concede to the government that my new product is something old that they've been regulating, and I'm going to destroy the power of these rent-seeking coalitions to be able to stop innovation. I'm going to make life better for the rest of us. I'm going to improve the rule of law. So it was more of a theoretical point. I'm sorry. I'm a I'm a law professor, so I think theoretically, with I got the pointy head to show it. To
let me, I'll close on close out this point. We can go to any other questions, but I don't think we have any disagreement. I mean, I totally agree with you. The rule of law is being eroded here more than it's being promoted. My point was simply to say, if Adam does in fact fall under the statutory rubric, if it is expansive enough to do that, and the recommendation is to just live outside it and hope for the best, that sort of widespread cultural acceptance, which again, I deal with this a lot in my interactions with clients, potential clients, it's coming to be known as commonplace. And I mean, I won't tell you, many of you follow the Quill decision, but the potential outcome on that, I've had tremendous people tell me, they're like, look, given my business model, I'm going to have 50 different states taxing me or potentially subject to taxation. I'm just going to ignore it. And so my larger point is that, if we start getting into this place where regulation is so expansive and broad that vast numbers of Americans have just accepted that they're going to be living outside the law unless someone is really willing to start swatting flies, that I do think that there is value or there is impact on the rule of law long term. But I otherwise totally agree that statutory misapplication presents another threat to the rule of law, though albeit a very different one.
Well, thank you very much for that question, Braden, for your response. I don't know if Adam had any response, but hearing him not chime in, I will move on here. I mean, I think that question is really fascinating. It leaves a lot for us here now to chew on. I'll plug for myself. I wrote an op-ed that was placed a couple of weeks ago on the anti-innovation culture in America and how it's driven by risk avoidance. And it certainly is also, I think, driven by the explosion of regulatory states' growth over a number of decades. And so it's an interesting thing to really think about and whether or not – I mean, I certainly don't share the thought that society thinks anything. I mean, we have to – sort of revert back to understanding that individuals have to make decisions for themselves and they have to think whether or not it's going to work, this permissionless innovation concept is going to work for them. And it's a scary prospect to branch out when, you can be fined or imprisoned. So it's a concerning thing. In any event, I don't see any other questions queued up, but if we do have any lingering thoughts here with our listeners or any questions, go ahead and ring in now, or else we're going to, I think, have some final remarks from our guests since we're coming up on the top of the hour, and we'll close out. So if you have a request or a question, you can request the floor by entering star and then pound on your telephone keypad. I'll wait a second to see if we have anyone ring in. Okay, I think that was our last question. Again, plenty to ruminate on there. Adam, Braden, do either of you have any final remarks you'd like to make? Anything that you haven't covered that you think we should?
The final point that I'll make, Devin, just to piggyback on your and Jeremy's comment, is there's very little cost for the regulatory boards in terms of exceeding their mandates. And therefore, I think that one of the larger reforms we should be pushing for is narrowing the scope of their administrative authority and then making it costly when they exceed it. And whether that's statutory causes of actions or attorney's fees, the sorts of things that discourage the abuse of that authority are institutional reforms that we should all be hoping for long term.
Thanks, Brady. Any final thoughts, Adam?
So we've talked a lot about innovation and it being stifled by these regulatory boards, and I just wanted to leave kind of on this last final thought. The phone that I'm talking to you on has more storage capacity than the entire U.S. government had in 1990. The MacBook that you could go – a high-end MacBook right now that you could go buy at Best Buy – would have been the most powerful consumer-grade computer in the world 20 years ago. The door-opening sensor that you probably have installed at your house is essentially unchanged since its design in the late 1800s. And I do think that has a lot to do with the fact that even if we win in Tennessee, we're going to have to fight this fight in, I think at last count, it was 32 other states. And to me, I just, as a society, I just don't know how sustainable the current system is. And I thank people like you and Braden for constantly fighting the good fight and trying to bring new innovation to people that need it.
Well, thanks, Adam, and thanks, Braden. I should say Braden is fighting a much tougher fight than I'm fighting, dealing with state boards. Gosh, through calcitrance, I can't imagine. In any event, on behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, I want to thank our audience for joining us today. It's been a very interesting conversation. I think it's raised a lot more questions for most of us than answering questions that we had when we started this program. But, of course, again, I'd like to thank you, Adam, and thank you, Braden, for joining us on the Free Lunch Podcast today. Hopefully, we'll have some folks who are on the call today join us for our luncheon event at the Capitol Hill Club in Washington, D.C. next week, Friday the 18th, from noon to 1:30, where we'll discuss other emerging technology, but in the transportation space and where regulation and legislation is developing, such as drone delivery, autonomous vehicles, flight sharing, and other things. But until then, take care, everyone, and goodbye.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.